Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are the Beatle Brains of Ireland, and we host Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles.
We might look at Beatles albums, we might tell you what books you need to be taking on holiday. We've done an episode from Abbey Road Studios, and we do live shows.
We've also had guests on our podcast, like Beatles biographer Mark Lewison and singer-songwriter Robin Hitchcock. Search for Nothing Is Real on Acast, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Available 8 days a week.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Nothing Is Real, a Beatles podcast, is powered by Acast. Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. This is part two of All Things Must Pass. And for this part, we're going to focus in on one song. And that song is... It's Johnny's Birthday. No, it's My Sweet Lord, which you all might have heard of. A massive hit and the lead single from the All Things Must Pass album. There is multitudes to tell about the song itself, wouldn't you say, Stephen?
I would say so.
And it's a, you know, this would have been the first thing that people heard from solo George. And, you know, it almost wasn't a single at the time. And it might not necessarily have been the most obvious choice for singles. Sometimes these things are obvious in retrospect.
Yes, my understanding is it was Phil Spector who was pushing for this as the single. George not necessarily very keen on that at all at the beginning. As you say, this is really the sort of the first thing people might have heard of his solo career. And a point you mentioned right at the beginning of the first episode is this doesn't sound like the Beatles. You know, there's nothing Beatly about this at all.
No, it's very much its own thing. And but it took a little while to get to where it got to. So let's rewind back. We mentioned in the first part that at the end of 1969, George is on the road with Delaney and Bonnie, and he's living, you know, having been asked by Paul to get in a bus and play as a band in various venues around the country. He has decided to get in a bus and play with a band in various venues around the country, that band being Delaney and Bonnie. And he rolls with the punches as camaraderie. He's literally on the bus and they're all playing guitars.
Yes, I mean, so he's just hanging out with musicians. And this is the sense that this is what he is looking for. He's looking for a sort of band of equals. In this case, he is the one, along perhaps with Eric Clapton, who are kind of stepping down and into this band of jobbing musicians. Billy Preston is there, and you know, he sticks with it all the way up to them touring in Europe. So he finds himself in Copenhagen, in Denmark, and that is where this song starts to germinate.
Yeah, and there is lots of cross-pollination, you know, if you look at that kind of 66 to 69 period, you know, Clapton is kind of the nexus of that kind of thing, but people coming out of John Mayall's Blues Breakers and Yardbirds and Zeppelin forming and all that kind of stuff. So there is this kind of musical chairs of really serious furrowed brow musicians playing meaningful music to, you know, people stroking their beards.
Yes,
I mean, George wants part of that action.
George wants part of that, and this is back to this point again that you touched on, this idea of authenticity, getting back to your roots. This, the band, it all comes back to the band, man. And it is all part of that move away from the kind of big superstar sort of solo spots, you know. So Clapton and Harrison are just submerged in the group identity. You know, Clapton is walked away from Blind Faith, which is, you know, the ultimate sort of supergroup vanity project. Dylan is doing his acoustic stuff, and there's just a downscaling and a kind of camaraderie amongst musicians, and it's being able to step away from your role as the lead guitar player in the Beatles or the guitarist from Cream and just work with other musicians.
Yeah. So My Sweet Lord begins in this environment. It's only a short period of time, you know, about 2 weeks at the start of December 69, when George is involved in that tour. It's about the same length of Wings' university tour in 1972.
It always comes back to
it
Wings.
It always comes back to Wings. But My Sweet Lord becomes, as you know, begins as sort of a kind of an open kind of vamp, doesn't it?
Yeah, so supposedly there was, the story is that there was a press conference going on, George wasn't at that, and he just began kind of vamping on some chords and fitting the chords to the words Hallelujah and Hare Krishna. And as he's kind of doing this, other members of the band are drifting in and out, and they're kind of joining in, and you just have this sense of this communal sing-along.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's evident in the final song. But they all just collaborate and they're singing along, and it's a kind of exchange of ideas.
And one of the songs that's often quoted as being a preview to this song is Edwin Hawkins' "Oh Happy Day," the Edwin Hawkins Singers hit "Oh Happy Day." That's a song that introduces a sort of universal spirituality in a gospel style to the top of the charts in the US.
Yes.
And there's certainly some of the DNA of that song is into My Sweet Lord, and that would have been in George's mind.
I think that's true. I mean, I've heard Billy Preston or read Billy Preston interviews where he said, you know, George asked him, you know, how do you write a gospel song?
Yeah.
You know, because that would not be something that George is familiar with. That's not part of the kind of Tin Pan Alley. It's not part of the Chuck Berry. It's not part of the R&B. It's not part of the sort of Brill Building stuff. So this is new to him.
Mm.
Yes, it's the Edwin Hawkins "Oh Happy Day" big hit, and most importantly, in the public domain.
Yes, which is something important that might come back to haunt George, as we'll discuss in a few moments. But Delaney Bramlett thinks that they were responsible for My Sweet Lord.
Yes, I mean, his story is that again, George is trying to write, you know, how do you write a gospel song? And he starts singing, "Oh My Lord," and his wife starts singing Hallelujahs in reply. And lo and behold, the song is pretty much written. The refrain is written. There was a very good piece in Mojo in 2001 by John Harris.
Mm.
And he compares that to the fisherman saying, you know, it was this big, the one that got away, that it's just a bragging story. And he doesn't give much credence to that. But it does seem either way. I think it is. It does have the its origins in a kind of collaborative sing-along.
Yeah, and my kind of feeling of it is that, you know, it's possible that the song might never have been thought of again by any of the people on that bus.
Yeah.
Only it becomes this massive hit 12 months later. And they're like, wasn't that something that we were singing on the bus?
Yeah,
kind of,
yeah.
Sort of. And whether it's the exact same or partially the same, you'd still attribute it to something that happened in your presence, I suppose.
The royalties on the bus go round and round.
Now, the thing I've always found interesting is that, you know, George's version of My Sweet Lord is not the version that people hear first.
No.
If people were listening, that is, because he does end up giving it to Billy Preston. And his version comes out before George's. So technically, George's version is a cover version.
It's a cover version, yeah. Yeah. So George is co-producing Billy Preston's second album for Apple, Encouraging Words, and that comes out in September 1970. So George is, as you said, originally thought he might give this to Edwin Hawkins, you know, but it ends up, and at this stage, it's unfinished. I think there's a general sort of acceptance that during the encouraging word sessions, they're still working on this. And we may put up a link to Billy Preston's version, but it is different. I mean, it you obviously know it's the same song, but it is a very different arrangement. So it's still a work in progress. It's a very flexible thing.
Yeah, and I guess that's the nature of the song itself. I mean, obviously, George's final version is so hugely familiar because it becomes so huge. But there is part of the song that is, you know, it's kind of created from thin air, that, you know, you take it apart and it is, you know, a spiritual, it's a vamp. Yeah. It's not necessarily, it's not like Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey, you know, it's its own thing.
It's a very simple thing. And if you break it down into its constituent parts, you think this must be a song that has always existed. You know, it has that feeling to it. It does have, you know, it does have that sense of a song that probably has been around for hundreds of years. But as I say, it's still being worked on. It's being fleshed out. And the Edwin Hawkins singers are actually in England touring at the time it's being recorded by Billy Preston. And they actually make an appearance. So, I mean, it's got very good gospel credentials.
Yeah, and that recording is in January 1970. So actually, it's quite hot off the skillet from Delaney and Bonnie by the time he hands it off to Billy Preston. But the flip of that is that, you know, Billy Preston then sits on it for 9 months. You know, whatever notion that this was some massive hit in the making wasn't obvious to anyone at the time.
No, and as I say, if you listen, we put up a link. It's a very different song, and although there were plans when Encouraging Words comes out in September 1970, this was going to be the single. So until the record company realized what they had in George's version.
And it's worth saying that Encouraging Words is a great album.
It's a very good album.
Yeah, very, very good album. So it's 5 months later that George starts to approach recording My Sweet Lord for All Things Must Pass. Yeah. And it's huge, isn't it, what the sound they managed to get.
It is. And I mean, I think this is the quintessential example of what, you know, Phil Spector can do with a couple of acoustic guitars.
A couple, yes, all playing at the same time.
He sort of, I was listening to this again, the song again in the remastered version, and the production is spectacular. I mean, it's crystal clear. You can hear the guitars.
Yeah.
So you can hear the individual instruments, but at the same time, you have a sense of a sort of massive sound. But it's not the sort of bombastic, over-the-top sound that sometimes infects a few of the songs on All Things Must Pass. It's a spectacular piece of production, particularly if you compare it with the Billy Preston version and if you compare it with the sort of various cover versions that followed in its wake.
And I think it's, as you say, the bombast is kind of missing because it doesn't really have any orchestral overdubs per se.
No.
The overdubs are mainly choral in nature. And
yes.
They're all George, isn't that right?
Yes, they're all George. So where, generally speaking, where you see credit to the George O'Hara Smith singers, that's George. And, you know, Spector has remarked on George's ability to harmonize with himself and to construct that type of vocal arrangement. And, you know, I'm sure it's only within the past few years that I realized that that was George. I mean, I assumed that was the massed ranks of a choir or singers that he had got in, but he painstakingly did this and overdubbed and built up the choir effect, and it's really quite striking.
It is. It's got it's kind of got Bohemian Rhapsody prototype vibes going on with this kind of self overdubs, or even good old Jeff Lynne would be known to be doing a bit of that as well.
Let's move on.
Got to squeeze in a reference somewhere, Stephen. So it's got this kind of touch on it, and you know, it has this kind of girl group feel as well.
This is where we blur
some lines.
It does. I mean, Billy Preston version is very clearly it's Oh Happy Day.
Yeah, gospel.
It's a gospel thing. But, you know, George doesn't come from that tradition. So we're talking The Chiffons, 1963 hit, He's So Fine.
He's So Fine. And nobody notices this, as far as we know, in the studio. Nobody starts to mention this fact that it sounds like this other song before it's made.
Apparently not even Phil Spector.
Yes.
The master producer of girl groups in the early... I mean, it's a carbon copy, you know, and this is Phil Spector's doing the arranging and the producing, and it comes out that way. And you think, did he not notice or was he not present?
He might not have been present because he wasn't present for some of it. But it might have been the fact that the song is taken on so many forms and has been so familiar and has become embedded in the months of being put together and being bounced from the tour bus to Billy Preston to, you know, to George himself, that, you know, it just had kind of passed them by. They'd just kind of gotten used to it for being its own thing. Certainly one of the things that pushed this to the prominence, the He's So Fine issue, was the fact that it did become the single, because the initial plan was that there was going to be no single from All Things Must Pass.
That's right. There was going to be no single. And then there was talk of Isn't It a Pity being the single. And then it was actually Alan Steckler in Apple, along with Alan Klein and Phil Spector. They all started pushing for My Sweet Lord to be the lead single, to be the single that was going to promote. George, not confident about this at all. And you can see that. You can see it's... Although there's a clear sense with this album, I think that he's wanting to put a lot of clear blue water between himself and the Beatles. This is quite an extreme example of that. I mean, you just cannot comprehend this song ever having been released by the Beatles. You know, we all play that game of, you know, what would the Beatles' 1970 album have been, or the 1971 album? I mean, I don't think anyone would put My Sweet Lord on a Beatles album.
It is a credit to the song itself that it transcends what it's about, even, and it's also transcendent. But, you know, if you were to read on paper, say in September 1970, that George Harrison's debut solo single ahead of his debut solo album is going to be a big 4 to 5 minute spiritual sing-along Hare Krishna style chant, you would have thought, oh, I hope I like his new direction. That's interesting. You know, we're so used to hearing it now, we kind of forget that it's a prayer.
Yes.
That's what George from the Beatles put out as his debut solo single, a prayer.
Yes. And George says, again, this is a direct quote, he said, "I was sticking my neck out on the chopping block because now I would have to live up to something. But at the same time, I thought, well, nobody's saying it. I wish somebody else was doing it."
Yeah.
But this is his signature solo song.
And, you know, we talked in the McCartney episode about the McCartney album, that album kind of comes out as a blank slate, that, you know, there's no McCartney album. He's keeping it under wraps. And then there is this McCartney album and people are disappointed in a way, or they're kind of, you know, they're it's not what they expect, or they're kind of surprised.
It's not what they expect.
And we mentioned on that episode that, you know, could it have been different if Maybe I'm Amazed came out as a single 3 weeks beforehand to kind of usher people in, to say, don't worry, there's this thing on this album, you know, it's a friendly song.
You think if that had happened, they might have been even more disappointed when they got the album?
There was an interesting thing I was reading recently about how Stephen Hayden, who's a journalist who's written this book about Radiohead, but he was also interviewing Jeff Tweedy from Wilco, and they were talking about how people's impressions of albums get formulated around one song. And normally it's the first song on the album, that whatever song you put up front on an album, that is what people will think that album is about, you know? Yeah. So if you put a quiet song up front, people think, oh, this is their introspective album. And it just might not necessarily be true. And I think it's also true for lead-off singles, that a lead-off single can, you know, create a friendly space or a friendly yes. song to say, you know, I love this tune. This is great. And so it gives you a nugget of love to bring into whatever album's about to follow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but there was no love nuggets for Paul when McCartney came out.
No, you get that on a t-shirt.
I think I'm getting my metaphors slightly.
No love nuggets for Paul. I think that's my favorite expression you've used on any episode.
But
anyway,
but My Sweet Lord is kind of, I think, it's instrumental in how we process All Things Must Pass, because I've joked before that All Things Must Pass is a fantastic double album. And, I'm trying to ignore the fact that there's an album of Apple Jam. If All Things Must Pass had come out with no single and Apple Jam was LP1, we'd have a different feeling about it today.
That's true.
So all this stuff, all this context is important. And My Sweet Lord is really important in terms of how we filter our love of All Things Must Pass.
I think that's right. But the other thing is, I mean, it's essentially an acoustic song.
Mm.
So for all of the sort of Phil Spector production, I mean, people talk about how over the top Phil Spector's production is on the album, and it's very sort of overblown. And, you know, George talked about that as well. But actually, you know, people tend to forget that more than half of All Things Must Pass is essentially acoustic.
Yeah.
It may be arranged by Phil Spector, and it may have string arrangements by John Barham, etc. But it's an acoustic album, and when the sort of big bombastic songs come in, they tend to overpower that. But as you say, My Sweet Lord does kind of set the tone. The thing that fascinates me is that, although you had Spector and Alan Klein pushing this as a single, did they have any conception of just how huge it was going to be?
They can't have. I mean, they obviously knew it was special, but they can't. You know, it still casts a shadow today, you know? What are the numbers? I mean, it sells a ton.
Yeah, so, I mean, some of the numbers here are, it says worldwide sales amounted to 5 million copies by 1978, and by 2010, it had sold 10 million copies.
Mm. There's a great quote from Rolling Stone here, which is, in 2002, they said, it is as pervasive on radio and in the youth consciousness as anything the Beatles has produced.
I think
I don't disagree with that.
At this stage, I think it's hard for us to get our head around just how big it was, how big All Things Must Pass was, and how quickly how unexpectedly, as well as how quickly, it sort of elevated George.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous to say he suddenly became a superstar. I mean, he was a Beatle, but he suddenly was on every radio across the world. His album was number one. It was a triple album.
Yeah.
He was outselling Paul and John and Ringo and everybody else.
But it also had that undefinable thing, and it's a bit of a lame phrase, but this kind of X factor thing. It grabbed the zeitgeist. It was its
yes.
moment. So it spoke to people. It delivered in a way that people delivered. It had a mysticism to it. And as we said in the first part, it wasn't a Beatles album. It was a Beatles, you know, you didn't have to like the Beatles to get on board with this record.
No. And it did, I think, although it's not a sort of personal confessional song, but it does kind of start that wave that had started of the acoustic singer-songwriter, acoustic music, wooden music in the late 60s, early 70s, that was going kind of hand in hand with the Led Zeppelin hard rock. You also had the rise of the sort of, with Crosby, Stills and Nash, and that. So it's kind of wooden music. It's nice organic music.
But at the same time, nobody else could have delivered it, I don't think, except George Harrison, the Within You Without You guy. You know,
yeah.
you weren't going to get a My Sweet Lord from Derek and the Dominoes, you know,
no.
even though the constituent parts are in the background.
Yeah.
You know, it that kind of spiritualism George had set those foundations back in the Beatles.
Exactly. He had that track record. So it wasn't just, people would know it's not just somebody jumping on a bandwagon.
Yeah.
It's a continuation of that. So.
Yeah. So as the saying goes, though, Stephen, where there's a hit, there's a writ. And it doesn't take long for the lawsuit to drop about My Sweet Lord being so close in melody to the song He's So Fine, which was written by Ronnie Mack. So it's actually the 10th of February 1971, where Bright Tunes, the publishing company that own He's So Fine, put out the paperwork to sue Harrison and Harris Songs and Apple Records for copyright infringement. So we're talking about 2 months after the single and album come out that the writ is there. So it happens pretty quickly.
Boom time for lawyers.
And we all love lawyers. They're
always
great people.
A good thing. There is no question to which the correct answer is not, we need more lawyers.
There isn't any problem that can't be made.
It can't be solved by throwing lawyers at it.
Yes. There's an interesting footnote. There was a cover version of My Sweet Lord that you pointed out to me by the Belmonts.
Yes. Formerly Dion and the Belmonts. So Dion has gone his own way, you know, a teenager in love, Dion and the Belmonts.
But they do this kind of doo-wop version of My Sweet Lord, kind of in the style of He's So Fine.
It's very strange. It's almost, it's sort of stamping feet. It's a very dull song, the way they do it.
It
doesn't do anything. Yeah, it is just a curio. It's a kind of novelty hit. And I think there's maybe like a kazoo on it as well. But it's a sort of a doo-wop version. And in the middle of that, they seamlessly segue into He's So Fine.
Yeah.
So you couldn't have, if you tried, sort of highlight any better the similarities between the two songs. And as you say, this then results in the lawyers
getting
circling.
Involved. So He's So Fine was written by Ronald Mack, and it was recorded by the Chiffons originally. And Mack had written the song, and it had been the Bright Tunes Music Corporation, who were based out of New York, who took the copyright of the song. And, you know, the basic 101 of the music business is that a song has a publishing house publishing company attached to it. And the role of the music publisher, the publishing company, is to monetize the song and collect royalties and to get them back to the songwriter. And they take a cut and the songwriter gets their cut. But they also have an interest, the publishing company, in preserving, I guess, what you would call the intellectual rights of the piece itself. So if they feel somebody else is monetizing their asset, that they have a right to stake a claim to that. Would that be a reasonable overview of?
I think that's a very fair summation of the.
I rest my case. No, that's legal, not how this works. Objection.
Of the legal position. And the thing to remember is He's So Fine was a massive hit.
Yes. Number one in America.
Exactly. It's not that this was a sort of an obscure song, you know, festering away at the lower reaches of the charts. This was a massive hit. It was number one for 5 weeks in America. It got to number 12. Mm-hmm. In the UK, when From Me to You was at number one.
So and the Beatles loved their girl groups. It can't have not been heard by them in some context at some point. You know,
absolutely. I mean, I think this is a point that we'll come back to. But it was one of the big hits of 1963 in the UK. So clearly, it was on their radar. Must have been.
So this lawsuit gets launched and. Alan Klein is still Harrison's manager at this point. So he's the first person dispatched to try and sort this out. What does he do?
Yeah, well, he goes and knocks on the door of the president, Seymour Barish, of Bright Music. And I mean, I imagine you don't want Alan Klein knocking on your door.
That would have been a friendly chat.
A friendly chat. So anyway, Klein is basically entering into negotiations with Bright Music, and his idea is that we'll buy your company, we'll buy the entire catalog. You know, Bright Music publishes various songs and has a portfolio, and the idea is, you know, we'll just buy you out, lock, stock, and barrel, and then we'll own it, and that'll be fine. Everything will be fine.
So fine.
It's so fine. And it's going to be a long episode. And, Bright Music, they, in the nature of things, they have a counter proposal, and they say, no, I tell you what, you give us the copyright to My Sweet Lord, this huge international hit, but in return, we will give you back 50% of whatever My Sweet Lord earns.
Yes.
And that's sort of the negotiating positions, and it seems to stick at that for a while. And then Bright Music goes into receivership.
Yes.
So a receiver is appointed, and in the nature of a receivership is the receiver is in there just trying to wind up a company, trying to maximize the value of the assets. And obviously one of the big assets is the litigation, the potential value of this litigation.
Yeah, so it kind of the it means that Bright Tunes is kind of frozen in a way.
Yeah.
And you know, there are, as you say, the real assets that it has, but there's also this potential thing. Does
yes.
does this potential case have value? And you know, there's a lot of modern day economics is based on risk and possibility and all that kind of stuff. But somebody would be looking at that to say, well, you know, what's it worth? And at the same time, Klein is also trying to have a look at whether the case has merit, isn't it? He's talking to musicologists about this kind of thing.
That's it. So, you know, Klein, and it shows you sort of the relationship between Harrison and Klein at this point. So Klein is really taking the litigation forward, the defense, and he finds a musicologist, a chap called Harold Barlow, who's going to be the expert to come in and say, these two songs sound nothing like each other.
Yes.
Good luck with that. this is all going on. The receivership has got in the way and things are sort of in limbo. But as you say, you know, there is a potential value here, and you think people will recognize this value.
Take a gamble, which might be a very lucrative gamble.
Exactly. And one of the people.
Well, it's interesting. There's a white knight comes in to see, can he buy Bright Tunes? What's his name?
Yes. His name is, I'll just check my notes. His name is Alan Klein.
Wait a second, Stephen. Alan Klein, who has been representing George Harrison, sees an opportunity to buy this receivership asset.
Yes. So,
but that doesn't seem right, Stephen.
Well, you know, I think that's a matter for the courts to decide, Jason.
But it wasn't like he was also supplying the receivers of Bright Tunes with insider information about the nature of George Harrison's claim.
No, I'm sure that wouldn't have happened.
Check my notes again.
I better check my notes again on that. So, I can see there is some passing mention to this. So, what has happened is that in March of 1973, Klein's contract with Harrison, Lennon, and Starr has come to an end, and that's slightly acrimonious and in the way of all things Beatle related. There's a raft of lawsuits to do with this. So,
and it is interesting to point out that, just to remind ourselves that, you know, the big split between Paul and John, George and Ringo was signing the contract with Alan Klein, and Paul maintained that Klein never represented him, and wisely their contract with Klein wasn't absolute. It was for a period of time, and they ended up, I think it was 4 years, they ended up letting the 4 years run out. And that takes us to the start of 1973, where they finally have no direct obligation to Klein anymore.
And so Klein is a free agent. So he goes off and says, you know, I'll buy Bright Tunes. So he starts negotiating. Now, at this stage, Harrison has made an offer.
Yes.
So Klein is aware of that. Klein is aware of all of the information that, on which that offer is based, is aware of, you know, what the musicologist Harold Barlow is saying to George about the song. So he has all of that.
He has insider knowledge of the potential value of this claim.
Exactly. And part of this was also Klein's own estimate on what the song was worth and what the earnings were and what the present and future owners of the copyright might be likely to receive. So,
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
The next step takes place in February 1976, and this is the case actually goes to court in the US, in New York, and George attends the proceedings, clutching his guitar, and he's called upon to, from the witness box to actually demonstrate the chord progression and how he wrote it and go over the background, and the experts are there. And
George's offer at this point, the offer he made before the trial was what, about $148,000.
That was okay. In January 1976. He was
so
saying,
that's what's been turned down.
Yes.
But he doesn't have a sense that Klein is involved in trying to buy Bright Tunes behind his back. He doesn't know that yet.
Not at this stage. So ultimately, the outcome of that trial is that in September 1976, the court finds that Harrison had subconsciously copied He's So Fine. Mm. So the judge says perfectly obvious that the two songs are virtually identical, and they were convinced that neither Harrison nor Billy Preston in his arrangement set out to take the melody, but that's not a defense. The key point here is they had access to the recording of He's So Fine. They knew it, and that is sufficient.
Yeah, they talk about in the ruling, don't they, about this intent to infringe.
Yes.
And I don't think there was ever any claim that George intended to go out and copy He's So Fine, but they don't have to prove the intent of him to copy the song, because the subconscious aspect of it is what matters, and the song just sounds like He's So Fine, and that's that.
That's it. And the ruling went to appeal on that point, and the appeal court was very clear in saying you can establish this infringement of copyright if the two things are substantially the same and the second composer had access.
Yeah,
is the word that they used. And Harrison conceded that, yes, that he had heard it, when it was popular. So he acknowledges that back in 63, he had heard the song, and that was sufficient to establish the second point, which was access.
But it's interesting because there have been other, many plagiarism cases before and afterwards. And there's a great book by Clinton Halen called One for the Money, if anybody wants to look at the history of music publishing, because let's take a step back for a second. You could argue it's kind of preposterous that you own a song.
That's true.
It's a construct that says that these things have a value that and a right, and there is a history to all that, and as Clinton Halen's book One for the Money outlines the last 140 odd years of music publishing, because it wasn't a thing once upon a time, and then it was a thing.
That's it, we've seen recently, you've got issues like sampling and that kind of copyright infringement, and there are a lot of developments in copyright law. It's not my area, and I'm not giving anybody legal advice, but it is very clear that this notion of subconscious copying, this really sets a direction for copyright law. This is a kind of a big case in establishing a principle, and arguably a lot of what we're seeing in copyright cases, even today, stems from the principles that are set out in this case.
But even the notion of access doesn't, like I've heard of copyright cases where access doesn't matter. So one of them would be Noel Gallagher versus Neil Innes for yes. How Sweet to Be an Idiot, the Neil Innes song being copied or plagiarized into the Oasis song, whatever. And Noel Gallagher said straight up, I have no idea who this man is, what this song is. I have never heard it. I don't know what it is. But as a Neil Innes Python head, the first time I heard whatever, I was like, yeah. Whoa, wait a second. And, you know, Neil Innes gets a co-writer credit on the back of that. So even access isn't necessarily.
What you have to realize is that, you know, copyright will be applied differently in different jurisdictions. There will be different tests, and generally, you know, these cases take place in the States or in the UK and wherever you think you have the best chance of succeeding. So the recent case that was settled where we established that Led Zeppelin never copied anybody. I think that's what it said. You know, a lot of the early stages of that litigation was around whether Jimmy Page could have heard the song.
We're talking about the Spirit song.
The Spirit song.
Yeah.
Taurus. And, you know, there were I think from memory, people were saying, oh, but they shared a bill at the Fillmore in 1969 or 1970, and this song was played. So, of course, he could have heard it. It's an absolute minefield, and particularly in the more recent cases where you have like blurred lines and that type of litigation, it's almost to the point where people are saying, oh, you can almost copyright the feel of a song.
Now. Blurred Lines by Pharrell from whatever it was, 2015 odd. Yeah, it got sued for copyright because it copied the feel of, was it Got to Get On Up from Marvin Gaye?
Marvin Gaye.
I might be getting the title of that wrong. And yeah, they don't share melody lines, but they do share a feel.
A groove.
And that has gone in the favor of the Marvin Gaye estate. The other thing that obviously involves plagiarism is whether or not you actually want to sue somebody. So Tom Petty famously sued one person, but then didn't sue another person. He sued Sam Smith for Stay With Me because he felt the melody line took from I Won't Back Down. But there's a Red Hot Chili Peppers song called Danny California, which absolutely has the same melodic structure as Mary Jane's Last Dance, and Tom Petty was like, "Yeah, sure, don't mind the Chili Peppers;
they're okay." One of the easy options here is just to give the other person a writing credit.
Yes,
and that does happen frequently. There was a Crosby, Stills and Nash album. Maybe Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young album, and Stephen Stills. Clearly, it was Subterranean Homesick Blues, so he just sucked Bob Dylan's name on it. So, but then that creates the impression that Stephen and Stills and Bob Dylan have sat in a room and written a song, or
K.D. Lang was hanging out with Jagger and Richards.
Yes, that's the other example. I've Seen My Baby. So a lot of the kind of copyright cases that we see today rest on the principles here that established very firmly that kind of notion of subconsciously copying something was a thing.
So he's so fine. The technical details about that were what? And this is where
I'm going to hand this over to you at this point.
Well, you're going to talk me through this because we're going to do a little something we haven't done before in the podcast where I've got a small musical piano that I'm going to try and tee up here. And we're going to try and play the repeated passages that
Are we going to get sued for copyright?
Jeez, I haven't really thought about that. I don't think that's totally possible, is it?
We'll soon find out.
We'll soon find out. Let's see. So what was the technical musical motif that they had a problem with?
Okay, so He's So Fine consists essentially of four repetitions of a very short basic musical phrase, which they called motif A. And that's sort of altered slightly to sort of fit the words of the lyric. And then that's four repetitions, and then four repetitions of a second short musical phrase, which they referred to in the trial as motif B. So if you let me know when you're geared up to play the first.
Okay, Stephen, phrase. I think I'm ready. I'm going to lower up here. Can we hear that? Okay, so the first phrase was Sol Mi Re motif A. Is that right? So that goes to that's the Sol Mi Re motif. Those three notes. And what's the second one? So La Do La Do. Okay. So La Do Ti Do. So La Do La Do. That's So La Do La Do. There you go.
There you go. So what the musicologists were saying is that neither of those motifs is particularly novel. But the four repetitions of A followed by four repetitions of B is almost unique.
So you're talking about four repetitions of
each motif.
Of those, and then four repetitions of... This is great. This is top podcasting.
This is top podcasting. So My Sweet Lord uses the same motif A, slightly modified to suit the lyric, four times, followed by motif B, repeated three times, not four, as in He's So Fine.
Yeah.
And then there's a sort of, in place of that fourth repetition, there's another little kind of passage. And the harmonies of both songs are identical.
Yeah.
So it really hinged on that... The repetition, the sort of the construction of using those two separate motifs. And I mean, I'm assuming at this point everyone will have gone and listened to He's So Fine.
I'm sure we can all listen to it in our minds.
Yeah.
So I'll just put my piano away, amazed by my musical skills. Oh, it's just extraordinary. So George is essentially found guilty. So then it becomes
That's not a word we use in a civil court, could I say? But
and he's sent to prison, isn't that right?
And he's sent to prison, and where he languishes to this day.
So sad.
We don't like to use the word guilty in civil proceedings.
Liable, is that the word?
We'll accept liable.
Okay,
we'll
so he's liable and he goes to jail. Yeah. No, he doesn't. But he's liable, and the liability becomes a fiscal liability.
It does. So there's then a second element to the trial where they have to say, right, now that you're liable, then we have to work out, how much money you're going to have to pay by way of compensation. And one thing that we should say at this point is that George is not having a great time generally because his contract with EMI has come to an end, and EMI decide to put out a best of compilation, pretty shoddy compilation. But naturally enough, they put My Sweet Lord on that compilation, so it's earning more money. And similarly, the Chiffons themselves in 1975, just to emphasize the point, put out a cover version of My Sweet Lord.
Excellent.
So it's just continuing to earn money, and this all has to be factored in. So they start then arguing about or making submissions to the court as to what the financial settlement should be. So basically the court or the judge has to decide how much money is generated by My Sweet Lord and how much of that money was due to its similarity with He's So Fine. Bright Tunes at this point are arguing, well, you also have to take into account that because of the single, people went out and bought that big expensive triple album.
Yes.
We should get a share of that as well. And, the B-side of the single also generated some money, and we should probably get a share of that. And you know what lawyers are like.
Lawyers. So I bet he regretted putting out his Love Nugget ahead of his album then, because it all added up.
This is going to be your new catchphrase, is it? Okay.
Nope.
I'll cancel the T-shirts. So the court basically said three quarters of the royalty revenue raised in North America from My Sweet Lord, as well as a significant proportion of that from All Things Must Pass album, must be taken into account, as well as the inclusion on the recent compilation. So they basically were saying three quarters of the success of My Sweet Lord was due to the plagiarized tune, and one fourth was due to George Harrison's lyrics, effectively.
Okay. And but they also went after the money that Apple made as a result of the success of the song.
Yes. So we've got, they're going after George, they're going after Apple, they're going after Harrisongs, which was the
the publishing company for Apple, for George, yeah.
Yes.
So all those people were deemed to have profited from the song. So the individual, the company, and the record company.
That's
and,
it.
And so what sort of numbers did they end up claiming?
Well, they said, and these were based on gross earnings in the USA and Canada, they said $54,000 for the single, $588,000 for the album, and a paltry $6,000 for the best of George Harrison, which is a little sad.
So that's George's personal,
that's
what they've calculated as, what he made from that song.
And then they looked at Apple.
Yeah.
And of course, George would have been receiving money from Apple as a sort of shareholder. But the similar formula there was $130,000 for the single, $925,000 from All Things Must Pass, and slightly more respectable, $21,500 for the best of George Harrison.
So Apple are on the hook for more money than George.
Yeah. So the total gross earnings for My Sweet Lord, $2.1 million.
All right. And they've said that three quarters of that has to be handed over as damages.
That's it. That's
okay.
it.
Okay. So that gives us, what, about 1.5? Well, it's 1,599,000.
So a little bit of haggling, but yeah, just shy of 1.66 okay. million. But in another twist.
Well, where is Alan Klein in all of this?
He has just bought Bright Tunes.
You're kidding me. That swine, that bounder, that cheat.
So between 1976 and 1981, Klein has completed his purchase. So he stands to get $1.6 million from his former client, George Harrison.
That is extraordinary. Like, the man is incorrigible. But
he took the risk. He made the gamble. Do you want to know how much he paid for Bright Tunes?
How much did he buy Bright Tunes for?
$587,000.
Oh my gosh.
So that's a cool 1 million profit, just like that.
You know what would have been funny? You know who was buying publishing companies in the 70s?
That would have been very funny if Paul had bought Bright Tunes.
If Paul had bought Bright Tunes, oh my God, he could have bought a nice motor. Anyway.
No anthology.
Oh my God.
No Fraser Bird, nothing. I mean, that would make his override look paltry.
So Alan Klein, in the background, has bought Bright Tunes for $587,000, which, irrespective of the catalogue, man, music publishing houses were cheap to buy in the 70s. It was a great investment. He buys that for $587,000, and then George has this $1.6 million that he owes Bright Tunes. So basically giving Klein a potential million profit. If only there was some way to appeal or say, that's not fair to the court.
Well, this is why it's very important to have good lawyers and lots of them.
So, so more lawyers turned up. And then what happened?
More lawyers turned up, and they file pleadings on behalf of George, saying this just isn't on. This is not cricket.
No.
And the judge agreed and said, you know, this is an outrageous breach of your fiduciary obligations to your former client, and you cannot be allowed to profit in this way.
You're a scallywag, Mr. Klein.
You're a scallywag. I think he actually used that word. And perhaps not. It was an American judge. He probably used something much more earthy.
So
he basically said, I tell you what, George can pay you $587,000.
The price you paid for Bright Tunes, George will give you that money back.
Yes. And George will get Bright Tunes.
Well, he certainly gets it. He's so fine. And he in the end, Klein doesn't make a profit. So he looks like he's cruising to make this cool 1 million profit. And in the end, he gets his money back.
George gets
the whole thing closed.
Yep. That's it.
And in essence, you could argue if he owns He's So Fine, George hasn't really lost much.
He hasn't lost much except all those legal fees.
Yes. Do we know where the fees were assigned to in the case? Probably to George.
Well, I think it's either George. I think it's George that makes a comment at one point that we bought a lot of lawyers' swimming pools and put a lot of lawyers' children through college. So collectively,
like that's a bad thing.
But essentially, George ends up owning both songs, and all is well.
All is well. It casts a long shadow. You know, George sang the song live on his brief touring jaunts, but I think he certainly had an axe to grind about the whole My Sweet Lord, He's So Fine affair for the rest of his days. For a man who was naturally tilted to being somewhat sour and cynical, it proved a lot of his feelings right about how these things were done.
I think that's fair comment. And should we talk about this song?
We should talk about this song. So this song is from 1976. It's a George single, and it's on the album 33 and a Third. And, you know, you realize going through all the facts and figures for this episode is that, you know, this song, when it comes out, this thing is still very much a live wire. I'd always thought this song had come out when everything was finished, but that's not the case at all.
That's not the case. I mean, the judgment, he's been found liable, and they're looking at the sort of financial settlement. As I say, the issue with Klein isn't resolved until 1981. But this entire lyric is a sort of reference to the case, and people are probably familiar. If you're not familiar, you should go and find the video for this, which is a very funny kind of spoof, slightly Python-esque. It's directed by Eric Idle. It stars Neil Innes. Ron Wood, I think, is in drag as a juror. Mm-hmm. Jim Keltner is in the video, and the whole thing is a commentary on the case.
Yeah. And the song has this line, this tune has nothing bright about it. See, folks? Bright tunes.
It's very clever.
Yeah, and it's got Monty Python voices and all the rest. There's a great quote from George here from 1978, which is, I won't do the voice. As far as I'm concerned, the effect the song has had far exceeds any bitching that's been going on between copyright people. It's just greed and jealousy and all that. Give them the song. I don't care. But I think he did care, Stephen.
I think he did care. And I think you're right. I think it was just one more confirmation of the sort of terrible way in which he felt he'd been ripped off all the way through the Beatles and on through.
My favorite last word in all of this is from 1980, John Lennon's Playboy magazine, because all of this kind of plays out during the years where John is very quiet. But shall I read it out?
Yes, you can read it.
John says he, i.e. George, he must have known, you know, he's smarter than that. He could have changed a couple of bars in that song and nobody could ever have touched him, says the man who wrote Come Together. But he just let it go and he paid the price. Maybe he thought God would sort of let him off. I think that's really funny.
That is very funny.
I thought God would let him off.
Yeah.
Just totally winding George up.
Ringo was much more charitable.
Oh, really? What did he say?
He said, no doubt the tune is similar, but how many songs have been written with other melodies in mind? It's much heavier than the Chiffons. He's just very unlucky that somebody wanted to make it a test case in court.
Yeah. And so, you know, way back at the start of this episode, you know, we were talking about the song and the spirituality of it and how great it is. But just like life itself, we've become bogged down in talking about the ins and outs of the lawsuits. It would put a man off the public sphere of performance, wouldn't it?
I thought you were going to say it would put a man off lawyers. But,
not at all. They not keep at all. The world going around. Let's talk about a couple of, to wrap up, let's just talk about some of the different versions of My Sweet Lord that are out there, because it is a song that endures. And, you know, it does pop up time and time again. So there's George's live version, so the Concert for Bangladesh and Live in Japan. So I guess they're two extremes. Concert for Bangladesh, it's still very much a new, fresh piece of the universe. Live in Japan is kind of a different type of thing.
It is, but on each of those live albums, you can hear the crowd reaction. I mean, particularly Concert for Bangladesh. I mean, there's a huge response when he plays that song, and that's a very kind of stripped back version. And you can hear George breaking off the main melody line to sing the backing vocals there as well.
And then Life in Japan is, I mean, I have my own feelings about Life in Japan. I think it's a bit wan as a live album. You know, I think it's unfortunate. I mean, it's a bit of a lost opportunity.
I think so. That's an album that I think really could do with being remastered and remixed. And possibly my understanding is, you know, Clapton played a few songs each night on those set, and I think there's a kind of slightly expanded version of that album waiting to come out. There was a review at the time, and it said it's like listening to paint dry.
Well, I still sometimes the best George album, although it's heartbreaking, is The Concert for George. That's an amazing live document of an amazing body of work.
It is. It was very good on the night.
Was it? Why? Do you know someone who's... Oh, never mind. There is a version, of course, in between those from December 1975 when
everyone's favorite version.
George, obviously in thrall and with his great friend Eric Idle, appears on his post-Python TV show Rutland Weekend Television, and he basically, if anyone hasn't seen it, it is very funny that George spends the whole episode wanting to talk about pirates or do pirates.
Yeah, he's dressed up as a pirate and wants to be in a sketch involving pirates.
And he keeps getting elbowed off the show, and at the end of the show there's this caption card, George Harrison sings, George descends down a staircase playing the intro My Sweet Lord. And then what happens?
Then he gets to the microphone and breaks into a sea shanty.
how he wants to be a pirate.
Well, how he wants to be a pirate. It's a pirate's life for me. I sailed the BBC. So it's very funny. It is very funny. Even though we've spoiled the punchline, it's still worth watching.
I'm sure most of y'all have seen it. And then towards the end of his life, George revisits the song one more time for the re-release of All Things Must Pass at the start of 2001, slightly belated 30th anniversary edition, just like we're probably in the realm of getting a slightly belated 50th anniversary edition. And I have to admit, the 2001 version of My Sweet Lord, I love it. It's definitely like those kind of Joni Mitchell, you know, later in life re-recordings. It's definitely someone who's 30 years down the line. It's infused with a little bit of Dylan. It's got a little bit of playfulness to it. But I really like that take, the 2001 version.
It's funny because, again, it's a version that really divides people.
Yeah.
Some people just cannot stand that song, that version, that they kind of, and it's very different. And I mean, I've heard people comment on other podcasts. There are other podcasts. I'm sorry, I've been listening to other podcasts
behind my back,
sort of saying, you know, it strips away everything that was great about the original in terms of that driving acoustic guitar, and it kind of seems to slow things down. I mean, he took the basic tapes from 1970 and just sort of built them up again and embellished them. But I agree with you. I like it. I don't think I prefer it to the original, but
It doesn't erase the original. People get precious about these things. So it's like, oh, I've got an extra version of My Sweet Lord, you know, which is, you know, he's singing it in a much more personal, reflective, you know, this is a guy who's looking at a different set of circumstances at the turn of the millennium kind of vibe.
I think so, and I it hadn't occurred to me, but you're absolutely right that it is a direct kind of parallel with those Joni Mitchell recordings, where you're singing a song with the benefit of 20 years experience and hindsight, and there is something kind of playful about it, and I suppose that maybe indicates, you know, he put all the plagiarism, the litigation, all of that behind him.
Yeah. So that's worth seeking out if it's not something you know. As a postscript, apparently there are no new melodies anymore. Are there, Stephen?
No, I think everything has been done, and copyright law is at an end. According to this is an article that I found in The Independent, the UK newspaper, in February 2020, where a musician had actually used an algorithm to generate every possible melody there ever was, or ever could be.
A piece of software that can generate 300,000 melodies a second and created a catalogue of 68 billion eight-note melodies that were copyrighted and pushed into the public domain.
So everything is in the public domain.
Ah, well, I can put it in the hands of my lawyer, but can I make it stand up in court? Isn't that kind of what we need to wonder about?
That's what we kind of wonder about. I can't believe you went with that joke.
I do apologize. Yeah, it's quite a tale, the tale of my sweet lord. But look, you know, whenever we talk about these things, our number one goal is just to make you think of the record and to go back and pull it off the shelf and have a listen, because that's what it's all about. It's one of the great songs, isn't it, Stephen?
It is. George's signature song.
It is George's signature song, and went back to number one for January 2002 after his death, and rightfully so, really.
So can we say it was the first number one single by a solo Beatle, and so far it's the last number one single?
Fingers crossed for Lavatory Lil. Let's see how that one works out. But what do you think, everybody? I think we know what you think. Everyone likes My Sweet Lord, but you can get in touch in all the usual places. We're available on Twitter at BeatlesPod. Stephen runs the Facebook group, so go and get a membership there. And if you want to leave a message wherever you get your podcasts, we appreciate all the good reviews. All Things Must Pass is a trilogy, and we're going to be looking at All Things Must Pass in a third part. So stay tuned for that, where we're going to go in deep on the album itself. But for now, my name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thank you for listening.
Nothing Is Real is powered by Acast.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.